No, I hope so. 22-4. Thanks, Kieran. Thanks so much, Kieran.
I agree.
Hello, everyone. I'm really, really happy to be here. Thank you so much, Paul Casey, for inviting me. Whoops.
Hey, Grant.
Oh, you're okay then.
Yeah.
This is a legendary reading series. I'm from New Jersey, as you can hear in my voice. Yay!
Yay!
Go
Patterson! Yes, Bruce. Patterson's where I was born. And I have a story to tell about that. And whenever I tell this story to people from this country, I'm always aware that there are at least 90 million other Americans who have said these words. And those words are, my grandparents came from Counties Cork and Counties Roscommon. But my grandfather was William Scott. No, sorry, not William Scott. That's my great-grandfather. His name was Christy Scott. And he was born in Cork, and his family had a shop on Pope's Quay. And so I'm really happy to be here reading in Cork. I have very little knowledge of that side of my family and their connection to the city. All I know is that they were called Scott, and there's very, very little else that I know. And my mother's mother was from County Roscommon. She was a Higgins. I won't tell you the whole boring story like many Americans do, and kind of tell you my whole life story right when I first meet you. But anyway, that's sort of how I ended up living here. I've lived here for almost 20 years in Leitrim, Roscommon, and now Sligo. So I'll start with a poem. One of the first poems I wrote, I moved here because I felt it would be good for my writing. I think most interested in speech and the way people talk. And a lot of the stuff that I write about is either influenced by things that I hear, things that people say, or ways people have of speaking, or things that people don't say. This idea of the disfluent, the opposite of fluency. And the first poem I'll read for you is one of the first poems that I wrote when I arrived here in 1996. I trained as a painter, and I heard about this nun in Derry who was called Sister Aloysius. She died a few years ago, but she was an icon painter, and I wanted to go visit her. So this is a poem about the visit. It's called Visit to Sister Aloysius. I was in Derry, so I phoned. She was gracious, as you'd expect from a Yale-educated nun. Her studio sat atop the old city wall and was filled with, peopled with, holy faces, a plethora of halos. Before painting, she lit a candle, a fat wax pillar of devotion, and prayed to Archangel Michael to guide her. Her icons are true, made with veritable stuff, and I believe that they do, for veritable believers, what icons can do. What I felt was a throb from the paintings. Gold leaf semaphored something cryptic, not about image, but urge. When I snapped this photo of Aloysius, I didn't know I was closing the shutter on my art career. To make an object that's wafer thin, to make something that burns, that'll dissolve on your tongue after you say it. Thank you very much for clapping. The second poem is, Michał is going to help me out with this poem. I have a gra for the Polish language. I love the sound of the Polish language. I don't know why, I don't have any connection.
I can tell you why.
Michałkiem, is it the consonants?
It's the most difficult language to learn in the world.
Okay.
Believe it or not, you can check it.
Yeah, well, I try. I'm eternally trying to learn the Polish language. I won't tell you the whole story, but I have old friends from Poland, and I've been there and visited many times. And one day I was standing in this old synagogue, the oldest synagogue in Kraków, and it's a really amazing acoustic space, so that when you're standing here, you can hear what people on the other side of the room are saying, even if they're just whispering. But there's this beautiful consonantal sound of the whispering quality of the language. So anyway, I did this public art project on a staircase in Leitrim, and once a month I wrote a poem and installed it on the risers of the staircase. So in about 10 years ago, there were loads of, as you know, immigrants when the European accession happened, of Poles, and Carrick on Shannon had the highest number of Poles outside of Dublin in Ireland. So there were loads of Poles around, and that consonantal sound of the language was just in the air. So I wrote a poem, and every other line of the poem is in Polish, and it went down the stairs. So Michał's going to read the Polish side of it, and I'll read the English side. And you're going to start.
Yeah.
It's called No Bestseller.
Z tego wiersza nie będzie żaden bestseller.
I am writing no bestseller.
Bardzo możliwe, że tylko mojej córce.
Chances are only my daughter
będzie się chciało przeczytać.
Will care to read
te słowa po mojej śmierci.
This when I'm dead.
Jakże mam jej lub tobie wytłumaczyć?
How can I explain to her or you?
Że nigdy nie widzę wyraźniej.
Why my sight is never clearer?
Niż w tym wezbraniu, w tej.
Than in the welling up that.
Wypukłej chwili nieskończonego zwielokrotnienia tuż.
Convex moment of infinite extension, right
przed wypłynięciem łez.
Before tears fall. Dziękuję bardzo, Michał.
Premagu.
I'm going to read a few poems now from my latest book, which is called The Breadbasket of Europe. A lot of the poems are about being lost, and there's a lot of references to maps. I don't know that I can explain a whole lot. Maybe the poems will explain themselves about why I write a lot about being lost. But there's something about this slippage between being from two places and maybe not being from any one particular place very strongly. So this poem is called Treatise on Maps, and it references an artist, maybe you've seen her show, Kathy Prendergast. She had a show at the Crawford that, I think it just closed.
Yeah.
Wonderful artist. And this references a series of drawings she did of capital cities where she drew all the streets and the rivers but left out all the linguistic markers. And there are these beautiful, ethereal, kind of woven drawings in pencil. So I reference those here. Treatise on Maps. You need a map when you're lost. When you're lost, you look at maps. You look at a map when you don't know where you are. After you find the place where you are on the map, you know where you are. When you want to have a picture of where you are, have been, would like to go, you look at a map. How do you make a map? Well, a lot get made on cocktail napkins using lines, dots, X's, and squares. William Smith just started walking, looking at rocks and fossils. He drew it all out and colored it in. Then a bunch of rich guys ripped it off, and that's how geology got started. That would be in England. Kathy Prendergast spent an awful lot of time drawing maps of capital cities with 9H pencils. They're beautiful, they're in Imma, which is in Dublin, but it's not Imma on the map. It's the Royal Hospital Kilmainham. Thank you for clapping. I'll read you now two mirror poems. That is, I think maybe there's a few ways of writing mirror poems, but the way that these are written is if you took the poem and you folded it in half, the end line of every stanza in the first half would meet and cover its mate in the second stanza, and they'd be either synonyms or homonyms. They'd be somehow rhyming, either visually or by sound. So the first one is called Geyser, G-E-Y-S-E-R, and there's a play on the pronunciation of that word, because here I've heard people call the geyser, you know, those things in Yosemite, I've heard them pronounce geezer, right? Well, we New Jerseyites say geyser. And so there's a little bit of a play on the word there. I don't find it. This poem is for my sister. Geyser. You emailed your whole desktop, which is typical. The blue of it, Scrovigni Chapel blue. A smile I've never seen before. It is, whoops, I'm sorry, I'm having eyeglass trouble. Far away. A smile I've never seen before, it is aware of smiling. Reveals itself to the camera in the computer. Squared off angels, no, they're JPEGs, hover. Over a faux Polaroid, you switched to sepia mode, so I wouldn't look like a geyser. A river of years to reach such tender self-regard. For a moment, you are unencumbered by the monster critical eye. You meant geyser. Scissored hair blunt and sister-like and merciful, your entire kitchen liquid in the glossy Frigidaire. It puts me in mind of Fra Angelico, those tricky frescoes. I seem to translate everything to Quattrocento time. Christ in a blindfold, eyes like poached eggs gazing down and inward, the gathered regal robes, the marble throne all white and pouring up, yes, like a geyser, pouring up while Roman soldiers, unencumbered by their bodies, beat and spit and mock. I have always loved those arrested gestures, the mute green rectangle, beautiful as your computer in Philadelphia, where Safari's compass points permanently northeast, and the Finder icon smiles twice and benevolently, straight on and in profile. The second mirror poem I wrote in a caravan in Leitrim when I was first here. Everyone, I think the summer of 95, I don't know if any of you remember it, it was the really hot summer, everybody ate in the gardens all summer and were swimming and wearing tank tops and bikinis the whole summer. And then I arrived in 96 and it rained the whole summer. And everyone was talking about how great the summer of 95 was, the previous year. And so this poem was wrote in the summer of 96. It's called Thank God It's Dry. Disregarding Mary in the post office, the Mary with the permanent hairnet. It's promised bad. She headed off any brazen praise of bold good weather. 6 years coming this heat wave over Ireland. Mesmeric, the buzzing bees, checking stalks of self-heal, the way you check for mail in the pigeonhole before email. The lost years. How real life stalks the meat of you. Mesmeric the cabbage white. Bouncing dot in this karaoke meadow. It sings a song of good death. You lifted his coffin and headed off for mass behind a cousin in sleazy fishnets, the weight on four shoulders and off his. So I'm going to read a couple of poems that are set in a small village in North Roscommon, where I lived for the greater part of 15 years, and saw lots of changes through the Celtic Tiger. And this poem is about a slippage in time, really, between the time of one of my neighbors and how she inhabits it, and the time of me and my New Jersey marination in another kind of time, car time. Memorandum in winter. Cutting the engine when meeting her on the Boreen. Me in my Volkswagen diesel. She with her push bike. She with her plaid shopping satchel that billows like a windsock. Memorandum of my smugness. A tangled extravagance of white thorn and briar rhymes with her face, an opened map to consult before engaging the gears. Thanks for stopping and for the chat. Then she's a dot in the rearview mirror. Shannon, when it washes the shoreline, in the wake of a cruiser, slurs exactly like the Polish language you hear in Lidl, Friday evenings, 7 p.m., payday. That's what Jerry says. The river surface offers space to the song. Hammer taps of Latvians and Poles nailing planks of a deck. The space between water and sky holding sound. It is underloved and an amphitheater. Latvians and Lithuanians are nailing planks of grooved decking. It will be a nice feature of that riverside property. Their tapping underscores the distance between this side and that. Winter gales have made swift work of the billboard proclaiming 42 luxury bungalows, only two remaining. Crumpled up on the roadside now, 2x4 legs akimbo. A circus horse curtsy or steeplechase mishap. This next poem is called Developers. Greed got in the way. We built a fake estate. Levina says to see ourselves, we need each other, yet doorbells, rows of them. glow in the night village. Strands of lit invitations no elbow has leaned into, both arms embracing messages. Unanswered, the doors are rotting from the bottom up. It's another perplexing pothole in our road, loves. Hardcore from the quarry might make it level. Hardcore and cunning speculation into matters concerning love and doubt, concerning want and plenty. Oh, the places where pavement runs out and ragwort springs up, where lindenwood ends but doesn't abut anywhere neatly. A petered out plot of tato, tumbleweeds, bin bags, rebar, roof slates, offcuts, guttering, drain grills, doodads, infill, gravel. A not as yet nice establishment, possessing potential where we have no authorized voice, but are oddly fitted out for the pain it takes to build bit by bit. When the last contractions brought us to the brink of our new predicament, we became developers. I'll read you a couple sections from a narrative poem called Wailing Log. It takes place aboard a whaling ship in an unspecified time frame. I'll read you a couple sections, but not all at one time, because it's a longish poem. So here's just the first section of Wailing Log. I was pawing through stuff in the ship's hold. Little casks of spermaceti, big casks of Asti spumanti, when I cracked my noggin on a tamarack rafter. Who knows how long I was conked out for? There was no tossing as we flapped in the doldrums, and the fellows were all caught up reading Chomsky for numbskulls above in the forecastle. I was dreaming of poetry, of poppies and their papery orangeness, how I wanted them untainted, free from flamily, free from skirts. I think I even cried. When I came to and went above, they handed me a pair of slimy black gloves and pointed to the pile of whale entrails. Fish out the ambergris, sweetheart. Trails from the attack jets veined the skies, so I knew the war was still on. The deck was slick, but I scuttled up to where Mr. Ha was honing his flensing knife. The cachalot was chained alongside the ship, a humongous slab of blubber hung from the blubber hook, the weight of it heaving the ship to starboard. We started talking about the storyboard, the treatment, and we were broaching the fees when, for fuck's sake, the boys in the whaleboats rowed into view with a mother in tow. We'd be cutting in for days. It was virtual night for a week. Greasy black smoke enveloped the ship. My skin was scored with red welts from the spattered oil. I stank of burned sperm. We were completely fried, sleeping in 2-hour shifts. Copies of Chomsky languishing in the forecastle shelves, the covers curling in the damp. Me, I was regretting not learning Latin so as I could read Catullus in the original. I had a first century erotic scene from the House of Centurion thumbtacked in my bunk. It was gorgeous, and it got me through those lonely times between texts when he texted exes from. I'd get all shy, get all limbic, but to be completely honest, I loved it. Mr. Ha and I were pouring whale oil into barrels. The cooper could barely keep up with us. Said the cooper, "Man, you're right, sailors. I think you're no muckle a sailor if you cannot make a boy as well." Hot said I could get 16,000 smackaroos for one episode of Bally Kiss Angel. And I was like, what the poetry, knucking futs. Mr. Ha said he had an in with a Korean collective in Orange County, but it sounded like a racket, so I didn't make any verbal commitments. I wasn't going to think on him either. I told him, take it easy, take a fanzine to the forecastle. I'd finish up funneling the oils, but really, I just needed some space. I couldn't crack that pesky villanelle. Maybe I should just bag it, work up a treatment, put it into development, never look back. I felt all noble about the delicate instruments we'd be lubricating with our precious sperm oil. I thought of that massive wedge of a head, that stash of spermaceti couched in it, the fine, precise readings and measurements, hair's breadths, exactitudes, all the friction we'd be eliminating, the ointments, unguents, and salves, the multitude of accentuated cheekbones. I pondered ambergris. Now there's a gray waxy substance. Remind me, what do we need that stuff for? I was telling Mr. Ha about the Fusilli Jerry episode when the ship's bell clanged. The folks in the forecastle, well, they just got into a full swing Saturnalia. But somebody's got to catch the whales. Polly, I said, pack your queer ass, your javelin. No, make that a harpoon. The whale line was coiled, so ship shape, so mesmerizingly, so proverbial snake in the charmer's basket, it seemed a shame to muss it up. Men's hands have been snapped off in a line paying out fast. Of course, that's when your whale is sounding. Overheard in the galley. She likes a little of, you know, in her coffee rather than hen's milk. I scampered up to the crow's nest. It was as good a place as any to do a little bit of, you know, but nothing scanned. The waves hit the ship in Alexandrines. The smell of sawn pine wafted from the depths. The shipwright lap-straked a new whaleboat, the last stove in by a monster. Matchsticks it was. The clouds were all cumulonimbus. I gnawed hardtack. I wolfed cupcakes. They gave me shore leave to give whaling lectures to school groups, so I was in the Quaker meeting house with a bunch of Yankee Mormon youth, yammering and squealing every time I said sperm whale, the fecking Egypts. I screened the jumpy whaleboat film, and just as the whale line was paying out like crazy, my wraparound skirt came undone and flopped to my ankles, my Brazilian underthings, now outerwear. The kids nearly wet themselves, and I turned redder than a beefsteak tomato. I hopped the next skiff back to the whaler. I'll read a couple more poems. This one is one of the few that's set in over yonder in the USA. This poem is called Happy Valley. It references Cy Twombly, an artist who writes who makes paintings and drawings that look a lot like kind of handwriting. And what else is in here? Scriabin, the Russian composer, is kind of oblique-sounding Russian composer, is in here too. Happy Valley. The brook is this mix of roar and hiss, as if God has managed to scalpel a section of tempest and clothespin it in the woods, over there always, draped in the trees. While we eat white summer peaches from Celadon bowls, while the sun bleaches and blue jay squawks score the maple, oak, birch, and apple tree sky with their oblique Scriabine musics. 15 years since I have seen a real fall, her deciduous burlesque, her glistering things sifting on the old cider mill. A holy show. I hold a wooden fragrance and a sodden mush of crushed, flowing apples in a cache and will never give it up. The cardinal is the best bird because it is a red mark on the blank snow amid the charcoal Twombly of maple, oak, birch, and apple branches. Pines are green and far away, don't figure. My sister in spring is even prettier, her smile, the genuine quality of it, undiminished in the many months since I have been in Happy Valley. It roars and is constantly in spate because it has its reasons, spring being spring, plus my visiting. I'll read just a couple more. This is another one set in the US. There's one part of this short poem where the word school bus is seen in the mirror, and so it's spelled backwards, so just hear me. Read the word school bus backwards. The poem is called, it's a visual title, it's two brackets. So the title of the poem is two brackets like this, with a square space between them. There was the day that she was a space, holding the left and right reaches of days. We lived within that enclosure. How I omitted the story. Ridged rubber steps, I descended a Wednesday. SUBLOOHCS, reversed in a side view mirror cartouche. My slung satchel. Scatter of weak light that's been long swallowed. Underfoot, gravel, rock, salt, old snow, stubble of Mulligan's field already frost stiffening. Stand of high pines on the far side gauzed with every hour we ever sat in them, high. Secreting stashes of acorns earlier gathered and flung at our citizens. We had our reasons. Sometime I'll tell it. That field was a square space containing me and every moment that was mine without her death in it. Then the blue air inflamed with an engine, their unseen sedan waiting beyond. The car was a new word to seal me inside of after too long of not telling. Through the gap in the trees, I walked toward a language I didn't betray I already spoke. Our cul-de-sac, its smooth tarmac atom, short drive home. For an instant, I sailed on a loose tile in our front hall, then it halted in a berth of grout. My father opened his Chesterfield coat to enfold me in cigar air and tinkling change. Only in my feet was anything felt. My father worked in a factory that made typewriter ribbon. This poem was written for him about that. For people to type language on onion skin paper, my father, who was formerly a potato, took the shape of a car, a fedora, and a cigar. Ink was the emotion in the machine. The textile was besotted with it. He forsook his singular life for the privilege for us to have this language. I have been groping along the old ridges, getting myself properly angled so the sun shows the shadows and drills appear in the hillsides as if combed. You can glean this all clearly on Akil. I told you, we'll be back on the potatoes, I heard an old one say to another in a parking lot in Sligo. Potato ridges are long curved lines on the green hillsides of Ireland. Typewriter ribbons are long curved lines my father figured how to ink, cut, spool, box, truck out on the long curved lines of the highways of New Jersey. The feeling is the ink in the machine of the typewriter. The onion skin, crinkly and tactile, dotingly lures us, which is typical of the Irish, our intoxications, especially with potatoes in the text, which comes from textile in the Textile Corporation. My father's body bent at looms that wove ribbons, inked in due course, so the metal could strike language on the onion skin paper, fragile, parched fabric with a watermark, which when backlit, you can read poverty.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.